Random House Audiobooks and Books on Tape present Memoirs of a Geisha by Arthur Golden, read for you by Bernadette Dunn.
Translator's Note. One evening in the spring of 1936, when I was a boy of 14, my father took me to a dance performance in Kyoto. I remember only two things about it. The first is that he and I were the only Westerners in the audience. We had come from our home in the Netherlands only a few weeks earlier, so I had not yet adjusted to the cultural isolation and still felt it acutely. The second is how pleased I was, after months of intensive study of the Japanese language, to find that I could now understand fragments of the conversations I overheard. As for the young Japanese women dancing on the stage before me, I remember nothing of them except a vague impression of brightly colored kimono. I certainly had no way of knowing that in a time and place as far away as New York City, nearly 50 years in the future, one among them would become my good friend and would dictate her extraordinary memoirs to me. As a historian, I have always regarded memoirs as source material. A memoir provides a record not so much of the memoirist as of the memoirist's world. It must differ from biography in that a memoirist can never achieve the perspective that a biographer possesses as a matter of course. Autobiography, if there really is such a thing, is like asking a rabbit to tell us what he looks like hopping through the grasses of the field. How would he know? If we want to hear about the field, on the other hand, no one is in a better circumstance to tell us, so long as we keep in mind that we are missing all those things the rabbit was in no position to observe. I say this with the certainty of an academician who has based a career on such distinctions. And yet I must confess that the memoirs of my dear friend Nitta Sayuri have impelled me to rethink my views. Yes, she does elucidate for us the very secret world in which she lived, the rabbit's view of the field, if you will. There may well be no better record of the strange life of a geisha than the one Sayuri offers. But she leaves behind as well a record of herself that is far more complete, more accurate, and more compelling than the lengthy chapter examining her life in the book Glittering Jewels of Japan, or in the various magazine articles about her that have appeared over the years. It seems that at least in the case of this one unusual subject, no one knew the memoirist as well as the memoirist herself. That Sayuri should have risen to prominence was largely a matter of chance. Other women have led similar lives. The renowned Kato Yuki, a geisha who captured the heart of George Morgan, nephew of J. Pierpont, and became his bride in exile during the first decade of this century, may have lived a life even more unusual in some ways than Sayuri's. But only Sayuri has documented her own saga so completely. For a long while, I believe that her choice to do so was a fortuitous accident. If she had remained in Japan, her life would have been too full for her to consider compiling her memoirs. However, in 1956, circumstances in her life led Sayuri to immigrate to the United States. For her remaining 40 years, she was a resident of New York City's Waldorf Towers, where she created for herself an elegant Japanese-style suite on the 32nd floor. Even then, her life continued at its frenetic pace. Her suite saw more than its share of Japanese artists, intellectuals, and business figures, even cabinet ministers and a gangster or two. I did not meet her until an acquaintance introduced us in 1985. As a scholar of Japan, I had encountered Sayuri's name, though I knew almost nothing about her. Our friendship grew, and she confided in me more and more. One day, I asked if she would ever permit her story to be told. "Well, Jacobson, I might, if it is you who records it," she told me. So it was that we began our task. Sayuri was clear that she wanted to dictate her memoirs rather than write them herself, because, as she explained, she was so accustomed to talking face to face that she would hardly know how to proceed with no one in the room to listen. I agreed, and the manuscript was dictated to me over the course of 18 months. I was never more aware of Sayuri's Kyoto dialect, in which geisha themselves are called geiko and kimono are sometimes known as obebe, than when I began to wonder how I would render its nuances in translation. But from the very start I felt myself lost in her world. On all but a few occasions we met in the evening. Because of long habit, this was the time when Sayuri's mind was most alive. Usually, she preferred to work in her suite at the Waldorf Towers, but from time to time we met in a private room at a Japanese restaurant on Park Avenue, where she was well known. Our sessions generally lasted 2 or 3 hours. Although we tape-recorded each session, her secretary was present to transcribe her dictation as well, which she did very faithfully. But Sayuri never spoke to the tape recorder or to the secretary. She spoke always to me. When she had doubts about where to proceed, I was the one who steered her. I regarded myself as the foundation upon which the enterprise was based, and felt that her story would never have been told had I not gained her trust. Now I've come to see that the truth may be otherwise. Sayuri chose me as her amanuensis, to be sure, but she may have been waiting all along for the right candidate to present himself. Which brings us to the central question. Why did Sayuri want her story told? Geisha may not take any formal vow of silence, but their existence is predicated on the singularly Japanese conviction that what goes on during the morning in the office and what goes on during the evening behind closed doors bear no relationship to one another and must always remain compartmentalized and separate. Geisha simply do not talk for the record about their experiences. Like prostitutes, their lower-class counterparts, geisha are often in the unusual position of knowing whether this or that public figure really does put his pants on one leg at a time like everyone else. Probably it is to their credit that these butterflies of the night regard their roles as a kind of public trust, but in any case, the geisha who violates that trust puts herself in an untenable position. Sayuri's circumstances in telling her story were unusual, in that no one in Japan had power over her any longer. Her ties with her native country had already been severed. This may tell us, at least in part, why she no longer felt constrained to silence, but it does not tell us why she chose to talk. I was afraid to raise the question with her. What if, in examining her own scruples on the subject, she should change her mind? Even when the manuscript was complete, I felt reluctant to ask. Only after she had received her advance from the publisher did I feel it safe to query her. Why had she wanted to document her life? "What else do I have to do with my time these days?" she replied. As to whether or not her motives were really as simple as this, I leave the reader to decide. Though she was eager to have her biography recorded, Sayuri did insist upon several conditions. She wanted the manuscript published only after her death and the deaths of several men who had figured prominently in her life. As it turned out, they all predeceased her. It was a great concern of Sayuri's that no one be embarrassed by her revelations. Whenever possible, I have left names unchanged, though Sayuri did hide the identities of certain men, even from me. Through the convention rather common among geisha of referring to customers by means of an epithet. When encountering characters such as Mr. Snow Showers, whose moniker suggests itself because of his dandruff, the reader who believes Sayuri is only trying to amuse may have misunderstood her real intent. When I asked Sayuri's permission to use a tape recorder, I intended it only as a safeguard against any possible errors of transcription on the part of her secretary. Since her death, last year, however, I have wondered if I had another motive as well, namely, to preserve her voice, which had a quality of expressiveness I have rarely encountered. Customarily, she spoke with a soft tone, as one might expect of a woman who had made a career of entertaining men. But when she wished to bring a scene to life before me, her voice could make me think there were 6 or 8 people in the room. Sometimes still, I play her tapes during the evenings in my study and find it very difficult to believe she is no longer alive. Jacob Harhuis, Arnold Russoff, Professor of Japanese History, New York University. Memoirs of a Geisha. Chapter 1. Suppose that you and I were sitting in a quiet room overlooking a garden, chatting and sipping our cups of green tea while we talked about something that had happened a long while ago, and I said to you, "That afternoon when I met so-and-so was the very best afternoon of my life, and also the very worst afternoon." I expect you might put down your teacup and say, "Well now, which was it? Was it the best or the worst? Because it can't possibly have been both." Ordinarily, I'd have to laugh at myself and agree with you. But the truth is that the afternoon when I met Mr. Tanaka Ichiro really was the best and the worst of my life. He seemed so fascinating to me. Even the fish smell on his hands was a kind of perfume. If I had never known him, I'm sure I would not have become a geisha. I wasn't born and raised to be a Kyoto geisha. I wasn't even born in Kyoto. I'm a fisherman's daughter from a little town called Yoroido on the Sea of Japan. In all my life, I've never told more than a handful of people anything at all about Yoroido, or about the house in which I grew up, or about my mother and father, or my older sister, and certainly not about how I became a geisha, or what it was like to be one. Most people would much rather carry on with their fantasies that my mother and grandmother were geisha, and that I began my training in dance when I was weaned from the breast, and so on. As a matter of fact, one day many years ago, I was pouring a cup of sake for a man who happened to mention that he had been in Yoroido only the previous week. Well, I felt as a bird must feel when it has flown across the ocean and comes upon a creature that knows its nest. I was so shocked I couldn't stop myself from saying, "Yoroido, why, that's where I grew up!" This poor man, his face went through the most remarkable series of changes. He tried his best to smile, though it didn't come out well because he couldn't get the look of shock off his face. "Yoroido," he said, "you can't mean it." I long ago developed a very practiced smile, which I call my no smile, because it resembles a no mask whose features are frozen. Its advantage is that men can interpret it however they want. You can imagine how often I've relied on it. I decided I'd better use it just then, and of course, it worked. He let out all his breath and tossed down the cup of sake I'd poured for him before giving an enormous laugh, I'm sure was prompted more by relief than anything else. "The very idea," he said, with another big laugh. "You growing up in a dump like Yoroido, that's like making tea in a bucket." And when he'd laughed again, he said to me, "That's why you're so much fun, Sayuri-san. Sometimes you almost make me believe your little jokes are real." I don't much like thinking of myself as a cup of tea made in a bucket, but I suppose, in a way, it must be true. After all, I did grow up in Yoroido, and no one would suggest it's a glamorous spot. Hardly anyone ever visits it. As for the people who live there, they never have occasion to leave. You're probably wondering how I came to leave it myself. That's where my story begins. In our little fishing village of Yoroido, I lived in what I called a tipsy house. It stood near a cliff where the wind off the ocean was always blowing. As a child, it seemed to me as if the ocean had caught a terrible cold, because it was always wheezing, and there would be spells when it let out a huge sneeze, which is to say there was a burst of wind with a tremendous spray. I decided our tiny house must have been offended by the ocean sneezing in its face from time to time, and took to leaning back because it wanted to get out of the way. Probably it would have collapsed if my father hadn't cut timber from a wrecked fishing boat to prop up the eaves, which made the house look like a tipsy old man leaning on his crutch. Inside this tipsy house, I lived something of a lopsided life, because from my earliest years I was very much like my mother and hardly at all like my father or older sister. My mother said it was because we were made just the same, she and I, and it was true, we both had the same peculiar eyes of a sort you almost never see in Japan. Instead of being dark brown like everyone else's, my mother's eyes were a translucent gray, and mine are just the same. When I was very young, I told my mother I thought someone had poked a hole in her eyes and all the ink had drained out, which she thought very funny. The fortune teller said her eyes were so pale because of too much water in her personality, so much that the other four elements were hardly present at all, and this, they explained, was why her features matched so poorly. People in the village often said she ought to have been extremely attractive because her parents had been. Well, a peach has a lovely taste, and so does a mushroom, but you can't put the two together. This was the terrible trick nature had played on her. She had her mother's pouty mouth, and her father's angular jaw, which gave the impression of a delicate picture with much too heavy a frame. And her lovely gray eyes were surrounded by thick lashes that must have been striking on her father, but in her case only made her look startled. My mother always said she'd married my father because she had too much water in her personality and he had too much wood in his. People who knew my father understood right away what she was talking about. Water flows from place to place quickly and always finds a crack to spill through. Wood, on the other hand, holds fast to the earth. In my father's case, this was a good thing, for he was a fisherman, and a man with wood in his personality is at ease on the sea. In fact, my father was more at ease on the sea than anywhere else, and never left it far behind him. He smelled like the sea even after he had bathed. When he wasn't fishing, he sat on the floor in our dark front room, mending a fishing net. And if a fishing net had been a sleeping creature, he wouldn't even have awakened it at the speed he worked. He did everything this slowly. Even when he summoned a look of concentration, you could run outside and drain the bath in the time it took him to rearrange his features. His face was very heavily creased, and into each crease he had tucked some worry or other, so that it wasn't really his own face any longer, but more like a tree that had nests of birds in all the branches. He had to struggle constantly to manage it, and always looked worn out from the effort. When I was 6 or 7, I learned something about my father I'd never known. One day I asked him, "Daddy, why are you so old?" He hoisted up his eyebrows at this, so that they formed little sagging umbrellas over his eyes, and he let out a long breath and shook his head and said, "I don't know." When I turned to my mother, she gave me a look meaning she would answer the question for me another time. The following day, without saying a word, she walked me down the hill toward the village and turned at a path into a graveyard in the woods. She led me to 3 graves in the corner, with 3 white marker posts much taller than I was. They had stern-looking black characters written top to bottom on them, but I hadn't attended the school in our little village long enough to know where one ended and the next began. My mother pointed to them and said, "Natsu, wife of Sakamoto Minoru." Sakamoto Minoru was the name of my father. "Died aged 24 in the 19th year of Meiji." Then she pointed to the next one. "Jinichiro, son of Sakamoto Minoru. Died age 6 in the 19th year of Meiji." And to the next one, which was identical except for the name Masao and the age, which was 3. It took me a while to understand that my father had been married before, a long time ago, and that his whole family had died. I went back to those graves, not long afterward, and found, as I stood there, that sadness was a very heavy thing. My body weighed twice what it had only a moment earlier, as if those graves were pulling me down toward them. With all this water and all this wood, the two of them ought to have made a good balance and produced children with the proper arrangement of elements. I'm sure it was a surprise to them that they ended up with one of each. For it wasn't just that I resembled my mother and had even inherited her unusual eyes. My sister, Satsu, was as much like my father as anyone could be. Satsu was 6 years older than me, and, of course, being older, she could do things I couldn't do. But Satsu had a remarkable quality of doing everything in a way that seemed like a complete accident. For example, if you asked her to pour a bowl of soup from a pot on the stove, she would get the job done, but in a way that looked like she'd spilled it into the bowl just by luck. One time she even cut herself with a fish, and I don't mean with a knife she was using to clean a fish. She was carrying a fish wrapped in paper up the hill from the village when it slid out and fell against her leg in such a way as to cut her with one of its fins. Our parents might have had other children besides Satsu and me, particularly since my father hoped for a boy to fish with him, but when I was 7, my mother grew terribly ill with what was probably bone cancer, though at the time I had no idea what was wrong. Her only escape from discomfort was to sleep, which she began to do the way a cat does, which is to say, more or less constantly. As the months passed, she slept most of the time and soon began to groan whenever she was awake. I knew something in her was changing quickly, but because of so much water in her personality, this didn't seem worrisome to me. Sometimes she grew thin in a matter of months, but grew strong again just as quickly. But by the time I was 9, the bones in her face had begun to protrude, and she never gained weight again afterward. I didn't realize the water was draining out of her because of her illness. Just as seaweed is naturally soggy, you see, but turns brittle as it dries, my mother was giving up more and more of her essence. Then one afternoon, I was sitting on the pitted floor of our dark front room, singing to a cricket I'd found that morning, when a voice called out at the door, "Oi, open up, it's Dr. Miura." Dr. Miura came to our fishing village once a week, and had made a point of walking up the hill to check on my mother ever since her illness had begun. My father was at home that day because a terrible storm was coming. He sat in his usual spot on the floor with his two big spider-like hands tangled up in a fishing net. But he took a moment to point his eyes at me and raise one of his fingers. This meant he wanted me to answer the door. Dr. Miura was a very important man, or so we believed in our village. He had studied in Tokyo and reportedly knew more Chinese characters than anyone. He was far too proud to notice a creature like me. When I opened the door for him, he slipped out of his shoes and stepped right past me into the house. "Why, Sakamoto-san," he said to my father, "I wish I had your life, out on the sea fishing all day. How glorious! And then on rough days you take a rest. I see your wife is still asleep," he went on. "What a pity. I thought I might examine her." "Oh," said my father, "I won't be around next week, you know. Perhaps you might wake her for me?" My father took a while to untangle his hands from the net, but at last he stood. "Chio-chan," he said to me, "get the doctor a cup of tea." My name back then was Chio. I wouldn't be known by my geisha name Sayuri until years later. My father and the doctor went into the other room where my mother lay sleeping. I tried to listen at the door, but I could hear only my mother groaning and nothing of what they said. I occupied myself with making tea, and soon the doctor came out rubbing his hands together and looking very stern. My father came to join him, and they sat together at the table in the center of the room.
"The time has come to say something to you, Sakamoto-san," Dr. Miura began. "You need to have a talk with one of the women in the village, Mrs. Sugi, perhaps. Ask her to make a nice new robe for your wife."
"I haven't the money, doctor," my father said.
"We've all grown poorer lately. I understand what you're saying. But you owe it to your wife. She shouldn't die in that tattered robe she's wearing."
"So she's going to die soon?"
"A few more weeks, perhaps. She's in terrible pain. Death will release her."
After this, I couldn't hear their voices any longer, for in my ears I heard a sound like a bird's wings flapping in panic. Perhaps it was my heart, I don't know. But if you've ever seen a bird trapped inside the great hall of a temple, looking for some way out, well, that was how my mind was reacting. It had never occurred to me that my mother wouldn't simply go on being sick. I won't say I'd never wondered what might happen if she should die. I did wonder about it, in the same way I wondered what might happen if our house were swallowed up in an earthquake. There could hardly be life after such an event.
"I thought I would die first," my father was saying.
"You're an old man, Sakamoto-san, but your health is good. You might have 4 or 5 years. I'll leave you some more of those pills for your wife. You can give them to her 2 at a time if you need to."
They talked about the pills a bit longer, and then Dr. Miura left. My father went on sitting for a long while in silence with his back to me. He wore no shirt but only his loose-fitting skin. The more I looked at him, the more he began to seem like just a curious collection of shapes and textures. His spine was a path of knobs. His head, with its discolored splotches, might have been a bruised fruit. His arms were sticks wrapped in old leather, dangling from 2 bumps.
If my mother died, how could I go on living in the house with him? I didn't want to be away from him, but whether he was there or not, the house would be just as empty when my mother had left it. At last my father said my name in a whisper. I went and knelt beside him.
"Something very important," he said.
His face was so much heavier than usual, with his eyes rolling around almost as though he'd lost control of them. I thought he was struggling to tell me my mother would die soon, but all he said was,
"Go down to the village. Bring back some incense for the altar."
Our tiny Buddhist altar rested on an old crate beside the entrance to the kitchen. It was the only thing of value in our tipsy house. In front of a rough carving of Amida, the Buddha of the Western Paradise, stood tiny black mortuary tablets bearing the Buddhist names of our dead ancestors.
"But, Father, wasn't there anything else?"
I hoped he would reply, but he only made a gesture with his hand that meant for me to leave. The path from our house followed the edge of the sea cliffs before turning inland toward the village. Walking it on a day like this was difficult, but I remember feeling grateful that the fierce wind drew my mind from the things troubling me. The sea was violent, with waves like stones chipped into blades, sharp enough to cut. It seemed to me the world itself was feeling just as I felt. Was life nothing more than a storm that constantly washed away what had been there only a moment before and left behind something barren and unrecognizable? I'd never had such a thought before. To escape it, I ran down the path until the village came into view below me. Yoroido was a tiny town, just at the opening of an inlet. Usually, the water was spotted with fishermen, but today I could see just a few boats coming back, looking to me, as they always did, like water bugs kicking along the surface. The storm was coming in earnest now. I could hear its roar. The fishermen on the inlet began to soften as they disappeared within the curtain of rain, and then they were gone completely. I could see the storm climbing the slope toward me. The first drops hit me like quail eggs, and in a matter of seconds, I was as wet as if I'd fallen into the sea. Yoroido had only one road leading right to the front door of the Japan Coastal Seafood Company. It was lined with a number of houses whose front rooms were used for shops. I ran across the street toward the Okada house, where dry goods were sold. But then something happened to me. One of those trivial things with huge consequences, like losing your step and falling in front of a train. The packed dirt road was slippery in the rain, and my feet went out from under me. I fell forward onto one side of my face. I suppose I must have knocked myself into a daze, because I remember only a kind of numbness and a feeling of something in my mouth I wanted to spit out. I heard voices and felt myself turned onto my back. I was lifted and carried. I could tell they were taking me into the Japan Coastal Seafood Company because I smelled the odor of fish wrapping itself around me. I heard a slapping sound as they slid a catch of fish from one of the wooden tables onto the floor and laid me on its slimy surface. I knew I was wet from the rain and bloody, too, and that I was barefoot and dirty and wearing peasant clothing. What I didn't know was that this was the moment that would change everything, for it was in this condition I found myself looking up into the face of Mr. Tanaka Ichiro. I'd seen Mr. Tanaka in our village many times before. He lived in a much larger town nearby but came every day, for his family owned the Japan Coastal Seafood Company. He didn't wear peasant clothing like the fishermen, but rather a man's kimono with kimono trousers that made him look to me like the illustrations you may have seen of samurai. His skin was smooth and tight as a drum. His cheekbones were shiny hillocks like the crisp skin of a grilled fish. I'd always found him fascinating. When I was in the street throwing a beanbag with the other children and Mr. Tanaka happened to stroll out of the seafood company, I always stopped what I was doing to watch him. I lay there on that slimy table while Mr. Tanaka examined my lip, pulling it down with his fingers and tipping my head this way and that. All at once he caught sight of my gray eyes, which were fixed on his face with such fascination I couldn't pretend I hadn't been staring at him. He didn't give me a sneer, as if to say that I was an impudent girl, and he didn't look away, as if it made no difference where I looked or what I thought. We stared at each other for a long moment, so long it gave me a chill even there in the muggy air of the seafood company.
"I know you," he said at last. "You're old Sakamoto's little girl."
Even as a child, I could tell that Mr. Tanaka saw the world around him as it really was. He never wore the dazed look of my father. To me, he seemed to see the sap bleeding from the trunks of the pine trees, and the circle of brightness in the sky where the sun was smothered by clouds. He lived in the world that was visible, even if it didn't always please him to be there. I knew he noticed the trees and the mud and the children in the street, but I had no reason to believe he'd ever noticed me. Perhaps this is why, when he spoke to me, tears came stinging to my eyes. Mr. Tanaka raised me into a sitting position. I thought he was going to tell me to leave, but instead he said,
"Don't swallow that blood, little girl, unless you want to make a stone in your stomach. I'd spit it onto the floor if I were you."
"A girl's blood, Mr. Tanaka?" said one of the men. "Here, where we bring the fish?" Fishermen are terribly superstitious, you see. They especially don't like women to have anything to do with fishing. One man in our village, Mr. Yamamura, found his daughter playing in his boat one morning. He beat her with a stick and then washed out the boat with sake and lye so strong it bleached streaks of coloring from the wood. Even this wasn't enough. Mr. Yamamura had the Shinto priest come and bless it. All this because his daughter had done nothing more than play where the fish are caught. And here Mr. Tanaka was suggesting I spit blood onto the floor of the room where the fish were cleaned.
"If you're afraid her spit might wash away some of the fish guts," said Mr. Tanaka, "take them home with you. I've got plenty more."
"It isn't the fish guts, sir."
"I'd say her blood will be the cleanest thing to hit this floor since you or I were born. Go ahead," Mr. Tanaka said, this time talking to me. "Spit it out."
There I sat on that slimy table, uncertain what to do. I thought it would be terrible to disobey Mr. Tanaka, but I'm not sure I would have found the courage to spit if one of the men hadn't leaned on the side and pressed a finger against one nostril to blow his nose onto the floor. After seeing this, I couldn't bear to hold anything in my mouth a moment longer, and spat out the blood just as Mr. Tanaka had told me to do. All the men walked away in disgust except Mr. Tanaka's assistant, named Sugi. Mr. Tanaka told him to go and fetch Dr. Miura.
"I don't know where to find him," said Sugi, though what he really meant, I think, was that he wasn't interested in helping.
I told Mr. Tanaka the doctor had been at our house a few minutes earlier.
"Where is your house?" Mr. Tanaka asked me.
"It's the little tipsy house up on the cliffs."
"What do you mean, tipsy house?"
"It's the one that leans to the side, like it's had too much to drink." Mr. Tanaka didn't seem to know what to make of this.
"Well, Sugi, walk up toward Sakamoto's tipsy house and look for Dr. Miura. You won't have trouble finding him. Just listen for the sound of his patients screaming when he pokes them."
I imagined Mr. Tanaka would go back to his work after Sugi had left, but instead, he stood near the table a long while, looking at me. I felt my face beginning to burn. Finally, he said something I thought was very clever.
"You've got an eggplant on your face, little daughter of Sakamoto."
He went to a drawer and took out a small mirror to show it to me. My lip was swollen and blue, just as he'd said.
"But what I really want to know," he went on, "is how you came to have such extraordinary eyes, and why you don't look more like your father."
"The eyes are my mother's," I said. "But as for my father, he's so wrinkled, I've never known what he really looks like."
"You'll be wrinkled yourself one day."
"But some of his wrinkles are the way he's made," I said. "The back of his head is as old as the front, but it's as smooth as an egg."
"That isn't a respectful thing to say about your father.
Mr. Tanaka told me, but I suppose it's true. Then he said something that made my face blush so red, I'm sure my lips looked pale.
So how did a wrinkled old man with an egg for a head father a beautiful girl like you?
In the years since, I've been called beautiful more often than I can remember, though, of course, geisha are always called beautiful, even those who aren't. But when Mr. Tanaka said it to me, before I'd ever heard of such a thing as a geisha, I could almost believe it was true. After Dr. Mayura tended to my lip, and I bought the incense my father had sent me for, I walked home in a state of such agitation, I don't think there could have been more activity inside me if I'd been an anthill. I would have had an easier time if my emotions had all pulled me in the same direction, but it wasn't so simple. I'd been blown about like a scrap of paper in the wind. Somewhere between the various thoughts about my mother, somewhere past the discomfort in my lip, there nestled a pleasant thought I tried again and again to bring into focus. It was about Mr. Tanaka. I stopped on the cliffs and gazed out to sea, where the waves, even after the storm, were still like sharpened stones, and the sky had taken on the brown tone of mud. I made sure no one was watching me, and then clutched the incense to my chest and said Mr. Tanaka's name into the whistling wind, over and over, until I felt satisfied I'd heard the music in every syllable. I know it sounds foolish of me, and indeed it was, but I was only a confused little girl. After we'd finished our dinner, and my father had gone to the village to watch the other fishermen play Japanese chess, Satsu and I cleaned the kitchen in silence. I tried to remember how Mr. Tanaka had made me feel, but in the cold quiet of the house it had slipped away from me. Instead, I felt a persistent, icy dread at the thought of my mother's illness. I found myself wondering how long it would be until she was buried out in the village graveyard, along with my father's other family. What would become of me afterward? With my mother dead, Satsu would act in her place, I supposed. I watched my sister scrub the iron pot that had cooked our soup, but even though it was right before her, even though her eyes were pointed at the thing, I could tell she wasn't seeing it. She went on scrubbing it long after it was clean. Finally, I said to her, "Satsu-san, I don't feel well." "Go outside and heat the bath," she told me, and brushed her unruly hair from her eyes with one of her wet hands.
"I don't want a bath," I said. "Satsu, Mommy is going to die."
"This pot is cracked. Look."
"It isn't cracked," I said. "That line has always been there."
"But how did the water get out just then?"
"You sloshed it out. I watched you."
For a moment, I could tell that Satsu was feeling something very strongly, which translated itself onto her face as a look of extreme puzzlement, just as so many of her feelings did. But she said nothing further to me. She only took the pot from the stove and walked toward the door to dump it out. Chapter 2. The following morning, to take my mind off my troubles, I went swimming in the pond just inland from our house amid a grove of pine trees. The children from the village went there most mornings when the weather was right. Satsu came too sometimes, wearing a scratchy bathing dress she'd made from our father's old fishing clothes. It wasn't a very good bathing dress because it sagged at her chest whenever she bent over, and one of the boys would scream, "Look, you can see Mount Fuji!" But she wore it just the same. Around noontime, I decided to return home for something to eat. Satsu had left much earlier with the Sugi boy, who was the son of Mr. Tanaka's assistant. She acted like a dog around him. When he went somewhere, he looked back over his shoulder to signal that she should follow, and she always did. I didn't expect to see her again until dinner time, but as I neared the house, I caught sight of her on the path ahead of me, leaning against a tree. If you'd seen what was happening, you might have understood it right away, but I was only a little girl. Satsu had her scratchy bathing dress up around her shoulders, and the Sugi boy was playing around with her Mount Fujis, as the boys called them. Ever since our mother first became ill, my sister had grown a bit pudgy. Her breasts were every bit as unruly as her hair. What amazed me most was that their unruliness appeared to be the very thing the Sugi boy found fascinating about them. He jiggled them with his hand and pushed them to one side to watch them swing back and settle against her chest. I knew I shouldn't be spying, but I couldn't think what else to do with myself while the path ahead of me was blocked. And then suddenly, I heard a man's voice behind me say, "Chiyu-chan, why are you squatting there behind that tree?" Considering that I was a little girl of 9, coming from a pond where I'd been swimming, and considering that, as yet, I had no shapes or textures on my body to conceal from anyone, well, it's easy to guess what I was wearing. When I turned, still squatting on the path, and covering my nakedness with my arms as best I could, there stood Mr. Tanaka. I could hardly have been more embarrassed. "That must be your tipsy house over there," he said. "And over there, that looks like the Sugi boy. He certainly looks busy. Who's that girl with him?"
"Well, it might be my sister, Mr. Tanaka. I'm waiting for them to leave."
Mr. Tanaka cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted, and then I heard the sound of the Sugi boy running away down the path. My sister must have run away too, for Mr. Tanaka told me I could go home and get some clothes now. "When you see that sister of yours," he said to me, "I want you to give her this." He handed me a packet wrapped in rice paper about the size of a fish head. "It's some Chinese herbs," he told me. "Don't listen to Dr. Mayura if he tells you they're worthless. Have your sister make tea with them, and give the tea to your mother to ease the pain. They're very precious herbs. Make sure not to waste them."
"I'd better do it myself in that case, sir. My sister isn't very good at making tea."
"Dr. Mayura told me your mother is sick," he said. "Now you tell me your sister can't even be trusted to make tea. With your father so old, what will become of you, Chiyu-chan? Who takes care of you even now?"
"I suppose I take care of myself these days."
"I know a certain man. He's older now, but when he was a boy about your age, his father died. The very next year his mother died, and then his older brother ran away to Osaka and left him alone. Sounds a bit like you, don't you think?"
Mr. Tanaka gave me a look as if to say that I shouldn't dare to disagree.
"Well, that man's name is Tanaka Ichiro," he went on. "Yes, me, although back then my name was Murahashi Ichiro. I was taken in by the Tanaka family at the age of 12. After I got a bit older, I was married to the daughter and adopted. Now I help run the family seafood company. So things turned out all right for me in the end, you see. Perhaps something like that might happen to you, too."
I looked for a moment at Mr. Tanaka's gray hair and at the creases in his brow like ruts in the bark of a tree. He seemed to me the wisest and most knowledgeable man on earth. I believed he knew things I would never know, and that he had an elegance I would never have, and that his blue kimono was finer than anything I would ever have occasion to wear. I sat before him naked, on my haunches, in the dirt, with my hair tangled and my face dirty, with the smell of pond water on my skin.
"I don't think anyone would ever want to adopt me," I said.
"No, you're a clever girl, aren't you? Naming your house a tipsy house? Saying your father's head looks like an egg?"
"But it does look like an egg."
"It wouldn't have been a clever thing to say otherwise. Now run along, Chiyu-chan," he said. "You want lunch, don't you? Perhaps if your sister's having soup, you can lie on the floor and drink what she spills."
From that very moment on, I began to have fantasies that Mr. Tanaka would adopt me. Sometimes I forget how tormented I felt during this period. I suppose I would have grasped at anything that offered me comfort. Often when I felt troubled, I found my mind returning to the same image of my mother long before she ever began groaning in the mornings from the pains inside her.
I was 4 years old at the Obon Festival in our village, the time of year when we welcomed back the spirits of the dead. After a few evenings of ceremonies in the graveyard and fires outside the entrances of the houses to guide the spirits home, we gathered on the festival's final night at our Shinto shrine, which stood on rocks overlooking the inlet. Just inside the gate of the shrine was a clearing, decorated that evening with colored paper lanterns strung on ropes between the trees. My mother and I danced together for a while with the rest of the villagers to the music of drums and a flute, but at last I began to feel tired, and she cradled me in her lap at the edge of the clearing. Suddenly, the wind came up off the cliffs, and one of the lanterns caught fire. We watched the flame burn through the cord, and the lantern came floating down until the wind caught it again and rolled it through the air right toward us with a trail of gold dust streaking into the sky. The ball of fire seemed to settle on the ground, but then my mother and I watched as it rose up on the current of the wind, floating straight for us. I felt my mother release me, and then all at once she threw her arms into the fire to scatter it. For a moment we were both awash in sparks and flames, but then the shreds of fire drifted into the trees and burned out, and no one, not even my mother, was hurt. A week or so later, when my fantasies of adoption had had plenty of time to ripen, I came home one afternoon to find Mr. Tanaka sitting across from my father at the back table in our house. I knew they were talking about something serious, because they didn't even notice me when I stepped into our entryway. I froze there to listen to them.
"So, Sakamoto, what do you think of my proposal?"
"I don't know, sir," said my father. "I can't picture the girls living anywhere else."
"I understand, but they'd be much better off, and so would you. Just see to it they come down to the village tomorrow afternoon."
At this, Mr. Tanaka stood to leave. I pretended I was just arriving, so we would meet at the door.
"I was talking with your father about you, Chiyo-chan," he said to me. "I live across the ridge in the town of Senzuru. It's bigger than Yoroido. I think you'd like it. Why don't you and Satsu-san come there tomorrow? You'll see my house and meet my little daughter. Perhaps you'll stay the night, just one night, you understand, and then I'll bring you back to your home again. How would that be?"
I said it would be very nice, and I did my best to pretend no one had suggested anything out of the ordinary to me. But in my head, it was as though an explosion had occurred. My thoughts were in fragments I could hardly piece together. Certainly it was true that a part of me hoped desperately to be adopted by Mr. Tanaka after my mother died, but another part of me was very much afraid. I felt horribly ashamed for even imagining I might live somewhere besides my tipsy house. After Mr. Tanaka had left, I tried to busy myself in the kitchen, but I felt a bit like Satsu, for I could hardly see the things before me. I don't know how much time passed. At length I heard my father making a sniffling noise, which I took to be crying and which made my face burn with shame. When I finally forced myself to glance his way, I saw him with his hands already tangled up in one of his fishing nets, but standing at the doorway leading into the back room, where my mother lay in the full sun with the sheet stuck to her like skin. The next day, in preparation for meeting Mr. Tanaka in the village, I scrubbed my dirty ankles and soaked for a while in our bath, which had once been the boiler compartment from an old steam engine someone had abandoned in our village. The top had been sawed off and the inside lined with wood. I sat a long while looking out to sea and feeling very independent, for I was about to see something of the world outside our little village for the first time in my life. When Satsu and I reached the Japan Coastal Seafood Company, we watched the fishermen unloading their catches at the pier. My father was among them, grabbing fish with his bony hands and dropping them into baskets. At one point he looked toward me and Satsu, and then afterward wiped his face on the sleeve of his shirt. Somehow his features looked heavier to me than usual. The men carried the full baskets to Mr. Tanaka's horse-drawn wagon,
and arranged them in the back. I climbed up on the wheel to watch. Mostly, the fish stared out with glassy eyes, but every so often one would move its mouth, which seemed to me like a little scream. I tried to reassure them by saying, "You're going to the town of Sinzuru, little fishies. Everything will be okay." I didn't see what good it would do to tell them the truth. At length, Mr. Tanaka came out into the street and told Satsu and me to climb onto the bench of the wagon with him. I sat in the middle, close enough to feel the fabric of Mr. Tanaka's kimono against my hand. I couldn't help blushing at this. Satsu was looking right at me, but she didn't seem to notice anything and wore her usual muddled expression. I passed much of the trip looking back at the fish as they sloshed around in their baskets. When we climbed up over the ridge leaving Yoroido, the wheel passed over a rock and the wagon tipped to one side quite suddenly. One of the sea bass was thrown out and hit the ground so hard it was jolted back to life. To see it flopping and gasping was more than I could bear. I turned back around with tears in my eyes, and though I tried to hide them from Mr. Tanaka, he noticed them anyway. After he had retrieved the fish and we were on our way again, he asked me what was the matter.
"The poor fish," I said.
"You're like my wife. They're mostly dead when she sees them, but if she has to cook a crab or anything else still alive, she grows teary-eyed and sings to them." Mr. Tanaka taught me a little song, really almost a sort of prayer, that I thought his wife had invented. She sang it for crabs, but we changed the words for the fish. "Suzuki yo Suzuki, chobutsu shite kure. Little bass, oh little bass, speed yourself to Buddhahood." Then he taught me another song, a lullaby I'd never heard before. We sang it to a flounder in the back, lying in a low basket by itself, with its two button eyes on the side of its head, shifting around. "Nemuryo ii karei yo, niwa ya makiba ni, tori mo hitsuji mo, mina nemureba, hoshi wa mado kara, jin no hikari o, sosogu kono yoru." "Go to sleep, you good flounder. When all are sleeping, even the birds and the sheep, in the gardens and in the fields, the stars this evening will pour their golden light from the window." We topped the ridge a few moments later, and then the town of Sinzuru came into view below us. The day was drab, everything in shades of gray. It was my first look at the world outside Yoroido, and I didn't think I'd missed much. I could see the thatched roofs of the town around an inlet, amid dull hills, and beyond them the metal-colored sea, broken with shards of white. Inland, the landscape might have been attractive, but for the train tracks running across it like a scar. Sinzuru was mainly a dirty, smelly town. Even the ocean had a terrible odor, as if all the fish in it were rotting. Around the legs of the pier, pieces of vegetables bobbed like the jellyfish in our little inlet. The boats were scratched up, some of their timbers cracked. They looked to me as if they'd been fighting with one another. Satsu and I sat a long while on the pier, until at length Mr. Tanaka called us inside the Japan Coastal Seafood Company's headquarters and led us down a long corridor. The corridor couldn't have smelled more strongly of fish guts if we had actually been inside a fish. But down at the end, to my surprise, was an office, lovely to my 9-year-old eyes. Inside the door, Satsu and I stood in our bare feet on a slimy floor of stone. Before us, a step led up to a platform covered with tatami mats. Perhaps this is what impressed me so. The raised flooring made everything look grander. In any case, I considered it the most beautiful room I'd ever seen, though it makes me laugh now to think that the office of a fish wholesaler in a tiny town on the Japan Sea could have made such an impression on anyone. On the platform sat an old woman on a cushion, who rose when she saw us and came down to the edge to arrange herself on her knees. She was old and cranky-looking, and I don't think you could ever meet anyone who fidgeted more. When she wasn't smoothing her kimono, she was wiping something from the corner of her eye or scratching her nose,
all the while sighing as though she felt very sorry there was so much fidgeting to be done. Mr. Tanaka said to her, "This is Chiyu-chan and her older sister, Satsu-san." I gave a little bow, to which Mrs. Fidget responded with a nod. Then she gave the biggest sigh she'd given yet and began to pick with one hand at a crusty patch on her neck. I would have liked to look away, but her eyes were fixed on mine.
"Well, you're Satsu-san, are you?" she said, but she was still looking right at me.
"I'm Satsu," said my sister.
"When were you born?"
Satsu still seemed unsure which of us Mrs. Fidget was addressing, so I answered for her.
"She's the year of the cow," I said.
The old woman reached out and patted me with her fingers, but she did it in a most peculiar way, by poking me several times in the jaw. I knew she meant it as a pat because she wore a kindly look.
"This one's rather pretty, isn't she? Such unusual eyes. And you can see that she's clever. Just look at her forehead."
Here she turned to my sister again and said,
"Now then, the year of the cow. 15 years old. The planet Venus. 6. White. Come a bit closer."
Satsu did as she was told. Mrs. Fidget began to examine her face, not only with her eyes, but with her fingertips. She spent a long while checking Satsu's nose from different angles and her ears. She pinched the lobes a number of times, then gave a grunt to indicate she was done with Satsu and turned to me.
"You're the year of the monkey. I can tell it just looking at you. What a great deal of water you have. 8, white, the planet Saturn. And a very attractive girl you are. Come closer."
Now she proceeded to do the same thing to me, pinching my ears and so on. I kept thinking of how she'd scratched at the crusty patch of her neck with these same fingers. Soon she got to her feet and came down onto the stone floor where we stood. She took a while getting her crooked feet into her zari, but finally turned toward Mr. Tanaka and gave him a look he seemed to understand at once, because he left the room, closing the door behind him. Mrs. Fidget untied the peasant shirt Satsu was wearing and removed it. She moved Satsu's bosoms around a bit, looked under her arms, and then turned her around and looked at her back. I was in such a state of shock, I could barely bring myself to watch. I'd certainly seen Satsu naked before, but the way Mrs. Fidget handled her body seemed even more indecent to me than when Satsu had held her bathing dress up for the Sugi boy. Then, as if she hadn't done enough already, Mrs. Fidget yanked Satsu's pants to the floor, looked her up and down, and turned her around facing front again.
"Step out of your pants," she said.
Satsu's face was more confused than I'd seen it in a long while, but she stepped out of her pants and left them on the slimy stone floor. Mrs. Fidget took her by the shoulders and seated her on the platform. Satsu was completely naked. I'm sure she had no more idea why she should be sitting there than I did. But she had no time to wonder about it either, for in an instant Mrs. Fidget had put her hands on Satsu's knees and spread them apart, and without a moment's hesitation she reached her hand between Satsu's legs. After this, I could no longer bring myself to watch. I think Satsu must have resisted, for Mrs. Fidget gave a shout, and at the same moment I heard a loud slap, which was Mrs. Fidget smacking Satsu on the leg, as I could tell later from the red mark there. In a moment, Mrs. Fidget was done and told Satsu to put her clothes back on. While she was dressing, Satsu gave a big sniff. She may have been crying, but I didn't dare look at her. Next, Mrs. Fidget came straight at me, and in a moment my own pants were down around my knees, and my shirt was taken off me just as Satsu's had been. I had no bosoms for the old woman to move around, but she looked under my arms, just as she'd done with my sister, and turned me around too, before seating me on the platform and pulling my pants off my legs. I was terribly frightened of what she would do, and when she tried to spread my knees apart, she had to slap me on the leg, just as she'd slapped Satsu, which made my throat begin to burn from holding back my tears. She put a finger between my legs and gave what felt to me like a pinch, in such a way that I cried out. When she told me to dress again, I felt as a dam must feel when it's holding back an entire